That something so small should have such power, like the small bulb in the forest. The bulb, no larger than a thumb, and having survived the winter, how it fights for its life. At the first hint of spring, the first dripping of the frost from the pine needles onto the soil, the bulb in the belly of the mother begins to stir. Oh, how it fights. It pushes up with a magical power. The gravelly earth is rough against its tender shoots. Often it cries out, but no one hears it in the mother's belly. Still, it pushes harder, and when it edges up through the earth and the early light touches it, well, then it is frightened, for the sprout has never seen the light. Then the grazing elk steps on the tiny sprout, and it is hurt badly, but still it fights and suffers much pain. At last it finds the strength to grow again, but then the deer nips it. Still, the bulb does not give up, and still the sprout comes on, for nothing can stop it. It is new life. Isn't that just a beautiful description? It was written by Jerry Spence in his novel Half Moon and Empty Stars, a novel about Native Americans in the 1960s. It is an excellent book, a novel that deals with truth and justice, integrity, passion, and courage, the last several, of course, of which he touches upon in the passage I just read. This is a passage depicting the compelling calling of life to life. Life calls to life. And no matter how difficult, life responds insistently and inevitably. Life calls to life, and life responds. This is a sermon about that calling to life and our response to it. It is about courage, although not in the more classic sense of the word. It is not particularly about heroism or acts above and beyond the norm. Rather, it is about the courage of everyday life, the courage implicit in the response to life's calling to itself. It is about you and me, and that which calls us from our beds each morning, no matter how we long to stay cradled and blanketed, safe and warm and secure. It is about the instinct to survival, which in the more treacherous of human conditions is the siren which calls us most compellingly from our beds. We get up in order to seek sustenance and, to whatever extent is possible, to assure shelter and safety. The instinct to survive is unquenchable and defines courage at its most basic level. But even those in the most bitter and fearful of circumstances would still, I believe, be called forth by more than just the demands of sheer survival. Like Spence's small bulb in the forest, they would be called forth through all manner of pain and danger by the indomitable quest of life seeking itself. They would, and we are, called forth by a certain passion inherent in the life process, a passion toward growth that moves us beyond what is safe and sure. Author Ida LaShan tells of a dinner conversation she had one evening with a man, a new acquaintance, who told her he was an oceanographer by trade. As they were talking, he began to discuss the lobster, explaining that when a lobster grows to the point where it becomes too crowded in its shell and can't grow anymore, it moves out to sea in search of some relatively safe place where it can shed its shell. It is a terribly dangerous process, the man told Lashan, because once the lobster becomes naked and vulnerable, it can be dashed against a reef and killed, or it can be eaten by another lobster or a fish. Still, it takes that risk because that is the only way it can grow. That is the only way toward life. The instinct toward growth and life trumps any risk involved, no matter how dangerous. For the lobster, the risks and the drives are undoubtedly instinctive. Human beings, however, are moved more than simple instinct. We are moved by an unconstrained and unremitting curiosity. And we are moved, too, by the accumulation of knowledge, the growing store of knowledge fed by that curiosity, knowledge which informs our emotions and thus elevates courage beyond the basic level of a survival response. We know that life is fragile and death is certain. We know that pain, suffering, and torment exists, and that if not much of it has touched our lives, we are fortunate. We understand that many people are far less fortunate than we, an understanding that elicits a wide range of emotional response, including perhaps guilt, fear, denial. We know of rejection, abandonment, and loneliness, and thus we fear them. We have witnessed or experienced humiliation and ridicule, and we are afraid. All of these things may lead us to fear really putting ourselves out there like we would like, putting ourselves on the line, taking a stand. We may fear commitment. We may be afraid to make a choice, for to choose one thing at least implies the forfeiture of another. We may simply fear living our lives as lustily and zealously as we would like. I once, some time ago now, climbed into bed with my already sleeping husband, who is, and I should quit saying this because it's going to go straight to his head, but who is the light of my life. And also my much beloved dog, and yes, the three of us sleep together, and was suddenly overcome with a moment of such pure bliss, a feeling of such complete and total love that I backed quickly away from it, noting it ever so briefly, pondering it at greater length later, but not allowing myself to stay there to really experience it, even for a moment. It was too intense. And it somehow seemed too inviting to the fates who, if they were to take note, if they were to become aware of my utter happiness, might find it necessary to intervene in some way. You recognize it. To take away some of my happiness in order to create more balance in this weary world. This is clearly a common, if unconscious, fear of many of us who are so very blessed. Why are we so much more fortunate than so many others? How can we continue to avoid the eye of the fates which have so brutally pounded so many people throughout history, throughout the world? And if the fates were to find us, could we withstand the beating? Dr. Victor Lacerva addresses this in his book entitled World Words. In discussing the Latin word affectus, which means an openness in which we are vulnerable to the world around us, Lacerva says, It is paradoxically both scary and exhilarating to freely allow life to touch us. When we are closed off in fear and withdrawal, there is an illusory safety and protection. Note, illusory safety and protection. To greet whatever is arising at the moment with compassion and generosity is to expose ourselves to pain. It is so much easier to remain concealed than to risk exposure. Yet, he continues, when we are in a state of affectus, we enter into a new realm of possibility. We stretch the edge of our comfort zone, tasting the border where all growth takes place. By renouncing whatever holds us back from full engagement with existence, we welcome both danger and blessings. That conscious release of fear allows a magical doorway to appear, leading to our dreams, extending the energy of unimpeded awareness into the details of living. We become less self-centered, he concludes, learning to feel with and for others. Empathy, tolerance, and love are deepened because of our greater comprehension of our own susceptibility to pain and pleasure. And finally, he says, a delicate sensitivity develops to every aspect of the world around us and within us. A delicate sensitivity. I am sorry that I did not allow myself to dwell in the bliss for a moment that night. I missed out because I was unable to shed my protective shell and be vulnerable to the full experience of joy that presented itself to me. I was not in a state of affectus. I lacked the courage that life asked of me at that moment. And I needn't have. The magical thinking that made me feel for a moment that if I did not experience my joy, it would not be taken from me was just that, magical thinking. It was perhaps born out of some childhood mishap or injustice, or it may have been the result of some more existential fear, neither of which makes it any more legitimate. Life is a gamble. We can't make it any less so by not experiencing it, although certainly there is a time and a place for a bit of wisdom and caution now and again. But life is a risk. And I may as well tell you right now, we are none of us going to get out of this alive. But there are ways to deal with the fear that that knowledge may induce. A decade ago, we were shocked and horrified by the September 11th terrorist attacks on our country. For me, it was the beginning of a very long and hard growth process in which, among many other things, I began to come to terms with my own mortality. But in so doing, I also began to be fairly fearful of the future, and not insofar as the more ordinary fears such as traffic accidents, disease, or the death of a loved one. But rather, I became fearful of annihilation, both that of myself and that of the world. I became fearful of annihilation, which is different from the fear of death. For in death, we are not utterly destroyed and reduced to nothingness. In death, we still live on, at least, at the very least, in the memories of those who we have touched in our lives. My fear was that of annihilation, obliteration. I began to experience a sense of dread as an ongoing undercurrent to my otherwise very full and rich life. I would be content and laughing one moment and the next suddenly feel sucker punched by the intrusive memory of how at risk the world is, how imminent our potential demise. But as I continued to grow through that year, I seemed to move on in my growth process to a place that I eventually found to be very exciting. The step that moved me out of my dread was this, and I'll say it to you as much as I can, like the insight came to me. I don't have the right to dread. I don't have the right to brood or worry about all that can go wrong, the inevitability of death, the scary state of the world. The fact is, I have been granted this moment. That is all I have been given. It's all that any of us can have. I have this moment. I am responsible for this moment. And what a gift this moment is. I don't know if that speaks to you or if I can articulate it in such a way that you can understand how it spoke to me and continues to speak to me. But it has made me much less fearful about the future and much more passionate about the present. Life is scary, really scary. But I have this moment. I am safe in this moment, and I am mighty excited about all that this moment offers in the way of feeling and experience, as well as in the efforts I can make toward future moments, should they come. I think perhaps that is what La Serva meant by being in a state of affectus. Living in the moment is a very potential weapon against fear. And another is befriending fear. I no longer recall what wise soul once said, make friends with fear. But it was sage advice, make friends with fear. Fear is always going to be a factor in the life of anyone who thinks and breathes. Befriending it so that we are not both afraid of the fear as well as that which stimulates the fear is another step in making fear manageable. And yet another step is learning to step out in faith, to trust and to step out in faith. Civilization has, here and there, and in spite of all of the news and evidence to the contrary, come a very long way. We may, as a species, go forward two steps and back one, and occasionally forward one step and back two. But still, overall, we continue to go forward. There are many great and compassionate minds in the mix, and though their wise utterances may sometimes be lost in the shouts of those too afraid to be still, many of us hear them and are moved by them and act in accordance with them. And for the metaphysical among us, there may be something to be gained from trusting the great mystery or the great good. I believe that the collective human consciousness is largely benevolent, and that universal energy is positive, and so it may be okay to step out in faith, to leap and trust that the net will appear. Besides, what other choice do we have, really? We can remain anchored in the safe harbor, but we'll miss the excitement and adventures of the sea. We can stay safely tethered to the fence, but we'll miss running wild and free in verdant meadows. Who wants that kind of life? Unitarian Universalist minister Richard Gilbert said it well in his meditation entitled Letting Go. He said, "There is something to be said for letting go, for risking the uncertain, for putting oneself in strong life currents with a rich mixture of faith and fear. Unknown pools sustain us, forgotten instincts stretch our spirits to the surface where the air is clear and the water is cold and refreshing. Yes, unknown pools sustain us. Forgotten instincts stretch us. We have far greater resources than we imagine if we trust the process, if we trust our process and have faith in our own unfolding journeys. There is truly something to be said for letting go, for living with passion in spite of our fears, and for making our bold claim upon the moment and living it fully, giving it up only after it is spent and empty, and we are spent and full and content. I'd like to close with just one more poem, if I may. This is by Dawn Markova. Some of you may know it. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid and more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance. I love that line. I choose to risk my significance. To live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes to the next as fruit. I will not die an unlived life. May it be so.